You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman, and this is the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM, all across North America, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio in every major U.S. military base around the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide. This is the Tom Hartman Program. I am Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. You can also find me on Facebook. I'm a Democratic strategist and a syndicated columnist, and it's my pleasure to be here for 3 hours with you as we push into the weekend, because it's Friday, and thank God it's Friday. We might get a reprieve from some of these presidential Republican debates for a couple days. You know, it's funny because these Republicans, they keep on talking about how they support torture, and I don't think they need to tell us that they support torture, because watching these debates alone would make even the most hardened terrorist crack under pressure, giving us whatever we want. I want to welcome the first guest today. We're going to have a good lineup of guests today, but the first is one of my favorites that I have often when I'm filling in for folks like Leslie Marshall and Tom Hartman and Bill Press and such. Tina Dupuis, she is a syndicated columnist. She's the managing editor of Crooks and Liars, and someone I've known for more than a decade now, which is just frightening if you think about it. And she's got a bunch of great stuff we're going to talk about today. Joining me now, Tina Dupuis. Tina?
Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Now, are you in L.A. now, or are you still up in Berkeley?
I just got back.
You just got back.
So I'm back in Los Angeles.
We'll get into the Occupy stuff that you've been seeing. I mean, you've been to basically every Occupy location in the country and Canada at this point. But I wanted to talk about your column this week. GOP debates, shock and awe, two more weeks of this, or two more this week. What do you make of these debates? I mean, at this point, have we heard anything new?
Well, you know, the thing that I think that debate is a misnomer, because they're really not debating each other.
Right.
They actually agree on absolutely every issue, with maybe Ron Paul being the voice of dissent once in a while. But pretty much they agree with each other.
Well, he's like the modern day, you know, if this was a game show, he'd be the little red whammy.
Right. But, you know, I mean, it's like, so debate is really... it's not an accurate word. You know, they're pretty much on the same page with you know, all of their policies. And, you know, people keep on making the analogy that this is like Survivor. Well, on Survivor, someone gets voted off the island every week.
Right.
And, you know, they've had this, you know, hardcore group of eight for, you know, about 275 debates now.
Well, I think Rick Santorum would probably bristle at the idea of this being Republican Survivor. Because Survivor usually has a gay contestant or two, and they might have to shower together, and, you know, that's just, he couldn't handle that.
Look, I'm he probably can handle that, I'm just saying. but yeah, Santorum is the new, he's going to be the new previous front runner.
Well, yeah, who's left? I mean, at this point, I'm about to throw my hat in the ring and run for president.
Yeah, this week, Glenn Beck said that Rick Santorum is the new George Washington. that he didn't mean that he was wearing a wig and had wooden teeth.
Although, you know, when you Google George Washington, you get much better results. At least as far as Rick Santorum's concerned. I always call him Rick, don't Google me Santorum.
Problem.
So, I mean, we've gone, basically, we started out this race, and Mitt Romney was at about 25%. And the first front runner was a guy by the name of Donald Trump. Which makes sense, because, you know, he was preoccupied with the president's birth certificate, and he wanted to show America what he could do for them as a businessman, since he, you know, he had a casino that went bankrupt. I'm not sure how casinos go bankrupt, considering that the house always wins, but he did that. You know, people know him more from his reality shows. And then, I mean, if that wasn't enough to make every candidate in the race just scratch their head and say, you know, reevaluate their lives, you know, I'm in a race for the Republican nomination for president, and Donald Trump is leading me in the polls.
Right.
And then we moved on, and it was like Michelle Bachmann for a while, and then it was Rick Perry all of a sudden, and then it was, you know, Herman Cain, And now we're on to Newt Gingrich. I mean, what do you make of all this?
You know, I think that it's anybody but Romney. The evangelicals are very, very prejudiced against Mormons. They don't trust Mormons. They have a problem.
I thought you were going to say against the super wealthy. But
that
would be true Christians. Yeah, that would be true Christians.
Categorically false in every way.
Yeah, evangelical Christians look at the proverb of, you know, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to go into heaven. They see that not as a proverb, but as the, you know, a challenge to build a larger needle.
Yeah, this is the Republican Party. You know, we're not talking about Christians; we're talking about Republicans.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, and at the end of the day, it boils down to religion, and that's really not what's being talked about. But the reason why he only, you know, he can't get above 25% is because John Huntsman, who is way qualified, I thought it was pretty Machiavellian for Obama to hire him, you know.
Sure.
I mean, he was perfect in every way except for he has Obama cooties on him. but he can't get above 5% ever.
I think you just started a new Republican conspiracy, by the way, that Obama has something that he, like a disease that he's giving people that leave his administration. What are these cooties you speak of?
They become tainted with with being reasonable towards the president. Newt Gingrich did a tour with Al Sharpton at the very beginning of the Obama administration. They went to schools to talk about education. So, you know, and now he's like, you know, he's the purest of the pure, except for
Newt Gingrich being. I used to love that show on VH1 called Smells Like the 90s, where they played like videos and talked about pop culture. And I swear Newt Gingrich was on that 3 or 4 times, you know, like the number of wives he's had.
Oh, right, right. I think the Republicans are just going to have to, you know, hold their nose and vote for Romney. I think that they're going to, you know, go through.
But will they do that? I mean, never as one of these, you know, right wing candidates falls off the map. And they move on to the next one. None of them go to Mitt Romney. I mean, what happens when Republicans nominate so-called moderates? And let's be honest, Mitt Romney is not a moderate. He's just not conservative enough for their liking, and they remember his term as governor of Massachusetts, even though he may not.
Right. Well, I mean, the entire Republican Party has kind of moved to the extreme right. I mean, the Republican Party and the Heritage Foundation specifically in 1989 thought that the individual mandate was the solution to our health care issue.
Right.
And that's what they were for, and that was their alternative to Hillary care, and now it's, you know, the thing that they're all kind of rallying around against.
Now it's unconstitutional.
It has Obama cooties.
You can't force people to have insurance.
Right, exactly. So, but that was the same thing that Romney did. I mean, this is what he passed. It was very successful. People in Massachusetts really like it. It's a very popular program, so of course he has to run away from it.
Well, I mean, he does like running. I mean, he barely has one public event each week, which makes sense. I mean, he's basically running to be the nominee based on the fact that he ran once before, and that's a winning combination. I mean, in the last 30 years, only one Republican nominee has ever become the nominee without having run for president before, and that was George W. Bush, and look how good that was for us. Every other one of them, from just after Ford on down, they've run before, and in most cases there was a Bush or Dole on the ticket. So, this is what the Republican Party does. They pick people that are milquetoast and warmed over, and sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. Tina, I want you to stick around a bit because I want to talk to you about your experiences at all of these Occupy demonstrations around the country. This is Tina Dupuy. She is TinaDupuy.com. Follow her on Twitter at Tina Dupuy. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We want to hear from you. 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We'll be back in just a bit.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Tina Dupuy talks about the Occupy movement and the Cal Berkeley protests.
We've made our home in the city, and now it's time to face these corporate politicians.
It is Friday, and this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, once again, I am Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's KARLFRISCH.com. If you're just joining us, we are talking to syndicated columnist and managing editor of crooksandliars.com, Tina Dupuy. You can find her work at tinadupuy.com. That's D-U-P-U-Y. You can also find her on Twitter at Tina Dupuy. Tina, thanks for sticking around.
Thanks for having me back.
We've got a couple calls I want to get to. We've got Bill, who's watching on Free Speech TV. Bill, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You you had something to say about money and politics.
Well, it's a good way to get rid of the bad guys. The only way to do that is to get them out of office. So I have sent this proposal to Wisconsin, and he tells me that they're going to use it, the Democratic Party there and around the country, but your help is needed. What it is that the Norquist got the Republicans to sign a pledge that they wouldn't raise taxes.
That's gridlock, well, Grover Norquist.
Pardon?
That's gridlock, Grover Norquist.
Yeah, it sure is. But this pledge is to where politicians, and this would bring out the honest politicians, where they would pledge not to take special interest money, lobbyist money, and that's only public contributions, and that's all. The American people are starving for honest politicians, and if you can imagine, and I did this at a Democratic meeting, somebody said it isn't going to work. I held up a pledge like that, and I said, if I had a pledge like that that I signed and you didn't, you would lose, because you would be telling the American people and your constituents that you're there to support a special interest. I'm here to work.
Well, it would certainly, you know, having something like that with the teeth in it, like Grover's pledge does, because, you know, if you violate gridlock Grover Norquist's pledge, then you've got groups like, you know, his and others that will come after you spending millions upon millions of dollars. Tina, what do you make of that?
You know, I think any kind of reform that could make, right, usually we have either transparency or we have, you know, strict regulations on, and right now we have neither, right?
Right.
So we either have, secrecy, ridiculous secrecy, and we have, you know, few regulations. So right now it's as bad as it has ever been. So to me, either solution where, you know, there's more regulations or it's completely transparent and everybody knows where the money's coming from, would be a welcome change to what we have now, which is abysmal.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, you know, in while all of this stuff is happening in the presidential race, you've got candidates traveling the country, doing Letterman's top 10 list, appearing on all these shows to try and sell their books and boost their Q ratings so they can get a job on Fox News when this is all over. You've been traveling the country, visiting the Occupy installations all over the country and in Canada. What's been your impression thus far?
Well, my impression is that they know what they're talking about. These are smart people. They are, you know, the there's been kind of two media stories that have, or two media strategies, I should say. So there's like the agenda journalists that go in there and want to paint them all as stupid and or violent, and then, you know, put it on the Daily Caller, or it's the other kind of just as useless counterpart, where they just want to put up a live stream and kind of spam everybody with so much information that they can't decipher it.
Right, right.
So then we're still having, you know, 2 months into the occupation, everyone goes, well, what do these people want?
Well, I mean, it's a convenient way to brush them aside and try and, you know, avoid what is obvious to me and pretty much anybody I know that's been watching them, that this is about, you know, the corporations and the wealthiest of this country having all of the power, and they want a few simple things: campaign finance reform, Wall Street reform, tax code reform, making the wealthy and corporations pay their fair share, getting rid of corporate personhood. It's pretty basic, isn't it?
Carl, what do they want? yeah, exactly. And these are the people I have described, the people out there, as the children of the lost decade. They are kids who have come of age in a time when wages have flattened, the middle class and normal, you know, people who work for a living, their wages have not gone up. The rich have gotten extremely more rich. Costs have gone up. Healthcare costs have gone up. Tuitions have tripled. Tuitions in the UC system in California have tripled in the last decade.
Now, have their degrees tripled in value?
Right, exactly.
Because, you know, it's a promise that we made these kids when they were growing up. Study hard, graduate from high school with good grades, go to one of the great University of California schools, get a degree, and you'll be able to find a good job. You'll make more than you would if you didn't graduate from than you would have graduated from high school. You'll do better than your parents, and that promise is being broken.
Right, and you also have these kids that they, you know, in order, you know, because tuition has gone up three times in the, or you know, three times has
300%.
Right, 300%. Excuse me. That Pell Grants and all the student aids and federal loans have not gone up with the same increase in the same way. So they're having to take, you know, student loans with APRs that are, you know, comparable to credit cards. And they're coming. I've talked to people who have $200,000 in credit card debt, and I was like, that is unimaginable. There's no way you're lying. And then I did the math and going to an out-of-state college for 4 years, that's $50,000 a year, that could happen.
Well, you know, the goal of anybody who gets a college degree is really to be paying for that college degree for the rest of their lives with no hope of ever owning a home and maybe no hope of ever getting a job that can actually afford that college degree.
Right. And you're talking about, I mean, it's essentially sharecropping. That debt will never go away. You can't renegotiate it. It doesn't go away if you go into bankruptcy. And, you know, it sticks with you. So these, and then they get out of college and they can't get a job for over $10 an hour. So of course they're in the streets and of course they have real grievances, you know, and.
It's just insane, Tina, if you think about it. And I want to take these calls with you if you can stick around for another segment. We've got a bunch of people that want to talk to you about, what they're seeing out there in their own neighborhoods and the Occupy movement. This is the Tom Hartman program. We're talking to Tina Dupuy. This is Carl Frisch filling in today. And we'll be more with, you know, with Tina after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll take your calls on the Occupy Movement, 866-987-TOM.
Last Friday night, yeah, we did some table times. Then we took too many shots. Think we kicked the apple guy. Last Friday night, yeah, we mixed the credit card.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. That was Friday Night by the kids at Glee and my secret boyfriend, Darren Criss. Secret being that he doesn't know it and he's straight. So anyways, enough about me. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H.com. You can also find my Twitter feed and my Facebook fan page there and connect with me there as well. Join the email list. Get up to date on whatever I'm doing in the media and all the work that I'm putting out online. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Tina Dupuy. She's the managing editor of crooksandliars.com, one of my favorite websites. And she is also a syndicated columnist. We're taking your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the Occupy movement. And we've got a call. This is Howard in Donaldson, Arkansas, watching on Free Speech TV. Hello, Howard.
Hey, Carl, how you doing?
I'm good. So what are your thoughts?
Well, I just turned over here. I was watching the House debating on the budget bill, and they're actually talking about the Occupy movement and how each side saying that their point of view is the Occupy movement's point of view, but they are talking about it. So the Occupy is influencing the politicians in their debates. So I say keep occupying. Occupy whatever you can.
I think that sounds like smart advice. Tina, what do you make of that?
I think that's fantastic. And, you know, I asked an occupier this, and, you know, in D.C., in D.C., who are kind of wonkish because, they, you know, they're in D.C., and that's kind of the nature of the beast, you know, why they're resonating with people. And they said that because they are analytically correct.
That's great.
You know, they not only are they right, but, you know, instead of going, you know, you need to get the government out of Medicare, which never made any sense to anyone, you know, they're like, there's too many people or there's too few people who have too much. And, you know, and what they're saying is making sense because they are, like they said, analytically correct. And I love that they're changing the debate. I love that, you know, the Republicans decided that they were going to come out against Occupy at the very beginning and come out hard and try and paint them as, you know, anti-Semites and all this other weird stuff, a bunch of hippies and homeless people and whatever, to kind of marginalize them. And the more they're being cracked down by police and,
right.
and the Republicans, and there was a coordinated effort, 18 mayors with the Department of Homeland Security, Mayor Gene Kwan of Oakland kind of made this
switch. Whose entire staff seems to have resigned because of the actions.
Right, exactly, because she essentially went on vacation while, you know, a former Marine had his skull fractured by mercenaries.
Right.
You know, on her call. I mean, it was really bad. The second raid that they had in Oakland had none of that kind of chaos and violence from police, and so it really indicated that, you know, they really messed up the first time.
Tina, one of the things that you all are doing at Crooks and Liars, I mean, how many pizzas at this point have Crooks and Liars folks sent to the various Occupy movements around the country?
Okay, for the record, no one thought it was last for 2 months. I mean, it was really like something that was going to happen over a weekend, and, you know, we were just going to like...
And pizza's really only good the next day. I mean, unless it's Godfather's, and then it's never good.
It is, I think, around 50. I will probably get hell for this from my staff, but I think that there are around 50 cities that we've sent pizzas to. Our readers have donated $3, $2, you know, $10 to buy the Occupiers pizza.
And you can do that at crooksandliars.com?
That is right. We have a PayPal account set up because it was, you know, it's really expensive to buy an entire pizza for somebody. But, you know, if for $2 people feel like that, you know, they're giving a
And you've got to get your vegetables in, too. I mean, you've got to get – those vegetables are so important.
The Republican vegetables that we're giving out.
Republican Congress now classifies pizza as a vegetable. And if you think about it, that would mean that Herman Cain calls Republican vegetables sissy vegetables because he said that he only ate manly pizza, which was covered in lots of toppings that were primarily meat, and that pizzas with vegetables were sissy pizzas. So for what it's worth, I mean, we do have a call I want to get to. Chris, who's listening on KTLK in Los Angeles, are you there, Chris?
Good morning, Carl.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to all of Tom's listeners. My name is Chris. I'm a member of International Longshore and Warehouses Union.
Great.
I'm in Local 63 in San Pedro.
San Pedro, California, right there on the peninsula.
That's right. And my Local 63, along with Local 13, Local 94, and Local 26, are doing our 14th year. 14 years, Carl.
Wow.
Where we have fed 1,500 families a 70-pound basket of food with turkey and all the trimmings for Thanksgiving. These are families that are in need. And this year, we will be assisting the Harper Interfaith and San Pedro Catholic Charities, the Marhar House in Wilmington, Long Beach Head Start, Harvard City Day Labor Program, the Joseph P. O'Neill Stroke Center in Carson, and also other unions that are down with, you know, they are on hard times right now.
Right.
The Laborers Union, Local 802, which is a lot of workers that are laid off, and the Ship Scalers Union, Local 56, that are struggling, that are a struggling union as well. Now, they used to clean the holds of ships, and now that work has been taken over by hazmat.
Chris, is there a way that people listening at home can help out with this?
Well, you know, our event is in Wilmington this coming Tuesday. Now, all of the baskets are all spoken for now. They've all been assigned to families that are in need. But we do welcome people, other unions to come in, roll up your sleeves, come and get in our assembly line where we are actually putting food into the baskets. And if you have kids, we also ask that you bring your kids, because what happens if you got kids that have grown up always putting their hand out, I want, and they see people that are really in need,
right.
It clicks with them. So we've, you know, urged our union members to bring family, you know, young family members, come in and, you know, put in like 2 or 3 hours during our event. Our event is all day long. It's at 231 West C Street in Wilmington.
And for folks at home who are curious, Wilmington is in the South Bay of Los Angeles. It's near Torrance. Tina, you know, this sounds a lot like what the Occupy movement is doing as well. I mean, they're looking out for each other. When I was growing up, my family would not have been a middle-class family if it wasn't for labor unions. My father is very conservative, as you know, Tina. But when my father was disabled at work for a period of time, it was his fellow union members that brought food to our family so that my mother could take care of my dad and didn't have to cook.
Right.
So
it, you know, and my, you know, my husband works in the entertainment industry. He works in production, and we have this discussion all the time. He is management technically, so he is not union, but as much as management should be irritated by the unions, he tells me all the time that he's happy they're there because they save lives.
That's right.
And that if there weren't the unions, if they did not have them there, they would be working people more, and more PAs would die every year, and we would have all.
Yeah, but at least they'd be children, Tina. you know, we'd have kids working if they had their way.
But, you know, the vilifying of the unions has, you know, and we've kind of like, and people are like, yeah, the unions, whatever, and we've kind of let the kind of assault of our unions go over the past year, and I think that really the precursor to the Occupy movement was the teachers' unions in Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
And the kind of like, wait a second, this is something that we thought we had won this battle a long time ago. We thought this war was over, and we had no idea that, you know, we would have to defend unions again, that we would have to stand up for people who work for a living again and be able to take care of one another again. And really, this is a Republican idea that, you know, it's not the government taking care of people, it's people taking care of each other in charity.
But you see, what's different is that corporations get in the way because they want all the money. So when money's involved,
absolutely everything for the right wing,
right?
No matter what, if it's a good idea, if there's not some way to make money from it, then, you know, forget about it.
Yeah. It's scary and frightening. And I know you spent time in Madison, when all that stuff was happening. And just this week, people started circulating petitions to recall Governor Walker out there. People can go to recall, scottwalker.com.org, or Google it and, join in that effort if they're out in Wisconsin. I want to get into another caller. We've got John, who is watching on Free Speech TV. He's in Girard, Pennsylvania, which is, oddly enough, where my family's from. Girard, we've got only a few seconds. John?
Oh, you're from Girard, huh?
My family is. We've got only a few seconds. What's your question?
My question is it possible for all the unions to unite under one umbrella?
Tina, what do you think about that?
You know, I'm the wrong person to ask about that. I'm all for, you know, the unions having some solidarity with each other. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise.
All right. Well, we will get in a little bit more. If Tina, you have a few more minutes to stick around?
For you. Anyone else, I would.
Anyone else?
Right now.
Well, that's good. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking to Tina Dupuy. She's a syndicated columnist and the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. Toll free, 866-987-THOM. That's 866-987-8466. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. I'll be here all afternoon with you. We've got a bunch of great guests coming up, and we will be back after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with Crooks and Liars, Tina Dupuy.
Imagine there's no pizza. I couldn't if I tried. Eating all the tacos. Oh, Kentucky.
If you're not watching this on Free Speech TV, I was just waving a lighter around because that's so inspiring. It makes you really hope that there's a Yoko in his life. Tina, that's Herman Cain's number one hit single.
I know
climbing
exactly
the charts.
What that was.
This is Casey Kasem. And that was Herman Cain singing a song made famous by the popular John Lennon. And that was a horrible Casey Kasem impersonation, lost entirely on people under the age of 40.
I was going to say, wow, where's your Nixon material?
Yeah, I'll do Nixon in the next hour. Tina, I want to talk about Herman Cain because there's so much fun to talk about Herman Cain. And guys, in the production booth. Where's the bottle of water I did not ask for? Okay, here it is. I got the water. Tina.
Oh my gosh, you've gotten diva so quickly.
Haven't I? I asked for only blue M&Ms. Speaking of divas, Herman Cain. What do you make of the train wreck that is his book tour? I mean, presidential campaign.
You know, I mean, I think that he had one purpose. He was kind of propped up and promoted by the Americans for Prosperity. This is not a conspiracy theory. At the Americans for Prosperity Defending the Dream conference, he said he was a Koch brother from another mother. You know, this is not me just slandering him. This is the real thing. He was propped up, you know, kind of picked out of obscurity. He was a local.
Why would they do that to themselves?
The only reason he's there is to make the Tea Party not racist. I mean, he stood up, his first campaign video said, because I'm you know, because I'm here, that means the Tea Party isn't racist. So it was a PR campaign from the very beginning that they were going to rebrand the Tea Party as somehow being diverse because he's there. It was never in his contract to make them not sexist creeps. And so, you know, and so here we are. You know, I mean, the sexual harassment thing is really horrible. He said that he's never done anything inappropriate with anybody. And, I mean, there's a picture of him with a colleague who is his type. You know, the women who've come out and accused him are all, you know, gorgeous in their 40s blonde women. And there's a picture I put up on Crooks and Liars of basically, you know, he's taking a picture with her, and his thumb is essentially, you know, on where her, you know, underwire would be. And, like, it's just a very intimate place for you to put your hand on someone who you consider to be your equal and your colleague. You know, I think the picture is inappropriate. But and then on top of that, he was, you know, the CEO of a lobbying organization as he was harassing these women. I mean, this is like,
well, and you know what the number one policy goal of the National Restaurant Association is, don't you?
It's to keep down the minimum wage, isn't it?
Or no minimum wage.
No minimum wage. Okay, even better.
You know, my mom worked in the hotel industry and the restaurant industry for her entire adult life. And a lot of people don't know that the reason that we tip our servers, even if we have lackluster service. And Tina, when I met you, you were waiting tables when I was still in school and whatnot. And we were still very young people.
Did you stop saying that?
I know, right? it's because servers are not required to be paid minimum wage because they assume that the minimum wage threshold will be met by the tips they bring in.
I've actually waited tables in different states, and like Louisiana, for example, it's like $2 an hour. It was when I worked there, and then
and that was not in the 1920s, right?
That was not in the 1920s. Thank you for aging me drastically. in California, it was the minimum wage you got when you waited tables. But yeah, no, I mean this is really hard work, but it used to be. At least when I did it, it was a way that you could work part-time, and then, you know, for me, it was writing full-time.
Right. A lot of artists choose that.
For many years until the writing kind of took off.
Right, and now, for a lot of people, it's a job of necessity that they do for their entire income. And not by choice either. Those jobs are, I know people with master's degrees seeking server jobs. But back to a more entertaining topic, Herman Cain. I was wondering if you could talk about Libya. No, I'm just kidding.
Which one is that?
It's next to Uzbekistan.
Right. Like I said, he was only there. I mean, he wasn't really going to, you know, be a front runner. I mean, this guy wasn't, you know, to be vetted in any kind of serious way.
He had less vetting than the average Godfather's Pizza delivery boy. There you go.
God bless your staff for doing that. this was like, no one realized how much people did not like Mitt Romney, that they would have Herman Cain as their front runner for 3 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, you know the Romney campaign's sad when its talking point on background of the media is, look, we're holding strong at 25%.
Right, and just if he doesn't open his mouth and he wins every debate by simply not being as horrible as other people. I mean, this is a great campaign.
Well, and we remember how horrible he was in 2008. Who let the dogs out? I mean, he was just, it was a joke from left to right.
Corporations are people, my friends.
Why do you think that Herman Cain has not dropped further in the polls given, his propensity to show us how stupid he is?
Because he's not Romney? you know, because I think there's like this kind of, you know, I think race has a little bit to do with it. I think that hating other, hating politicians has a lot to do with it. I think that he, you know, he came out and he said, look, I'm not a politician, and Republican primary
That's
voters.
That's obvious.
Yeah, we, right. It's obvious he's not a politician, but people don't like politicians unless they, you know, meet them and then they like them. They're very charming people, but, you know, mainly people, you know, they also need used car salesmen at some point in their
right.
life.
Right. Well, you know, Herman Cain's,
they like them.
Herman Cain's campaign isn't in Iowa, New Hampshire that often, but you can meet him on his book tour because that's what this is really all about. Tina Dupuy, I want to thank you for joining me. She is a syndicated columnist and also the managing editor of crooksandliars.com. Go to her website, tinadupuy.com, D-U-P-U-Y.com. Sign up for her email list. Follow her on Twitter. It is 12:56, bottom of the hour. And coming up, we've got a lot of great content for you. You can find out more about me, Carl Frisch, at carlfrisch.com, where you can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Doug Kendall, the president of Constitutional Accountability Center, about gridlock Grover Norquist.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is hour two of the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I am Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. You can find me at carlfrisch.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook and every other social network you can possibly imagine. MySpace, Friendster, two rocks tied together with a string. You know, you can find me anywhere you want to. It's basically what I'm trying to say. If you're just joining us now, we spent the first hour talking to Tina Dupuy. She's a syndicated columnist and managing editor of crooksandliars.com. About the Occupy movement and the 2012 presidential race. Nothing could be left on the table when we talk about these Republicans if we don't talk about Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist, or as gridlock Grover Norquist, as I and others like to call him, it seems is single-handedly keeping Republicans in Congress from being able to negotiate in good faith. One of the groups leading the fight on Grover Norquist to ask the American people, ask these members of Congress, rather, whether they stand for their oath of office or for his pledge, is the Constitutional Accountability Center. And I'm joined now by their president and founder, Doug Kendall. Doug, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
Absolutely. So about 2 months ago, your organization launched the Constitutional Progressives. And I couldn't have been happier given how often I've had to subject myself to hearing right-wingers talk about how they're constitutional conservatives, that they support the Second Amendment, and then that was pretty much all they talk about. Why did you think that was important to do?
Well, I mean, Carl, we've been hearing increasingly extreme and outrageous claims about what the Constitution means coming out of the Tea Party, and you're right. They like what some of what happened in 1787, and they like the Second Amendment that happened in 1791, but they don't really like much else, and they're not really telling the truth about the Constitution, particularly the whole Constitution as it exists today. And so Constitutional Progressives was launched as a way of pushing back on that and taking back the Constitution for progressives and emphasizing that when you respect the Constitution, you have to respect all of it, including all the amendments passed over the last 220 years, including the parts like the Equal Protection Clause, like the 16th and 17th Amendment, which give broad powers to tax and give we the people power to vote for the United
States senators, right.
That we have a very progressive constitution. And so we launched a website at constitutionalprogressives.org that explains what the Constitution means. It talks about the whole Constitution, including the amendments passed over the last 220 years, and explains that the Constitution is at bottom, a very progressive document.
Well, it certainly evolved as a progressive document over the years. I mean, We've always moved towards expanding rights and liberty.
That's right.
You know, particularly liberties and freedoms that were not, you know, part of the original Ten Amendments.
Well, I mean, the original Constitution sanctioned slavery in the Reconstruction Amendments.
Wait. Now, hang on a second. My understanding, you know, I get all of my history and learning from Michelle Bachmann.
Right.
So
the framers worked tirelessly to get it out.
That's what I heard.
Except that many of them died slave owners, and the Constitution that they left to us protected slavery in a lot of different ways. And it took a very
Well, what about John Quincy
Civil War.
Adams?
John Quincy Adams was about 10 at the time the Constitution was signed, and
maybe he wasn't a founding father.
There were members of the framing generation that opposed slavery. Alexander Hamilton was part of anti-slavery societies, but the Constitution that they ratified as a compromise protected the doctrine in a lot of ways, and it took this incredibly bloody civil war to pass this 13th, 14th, and 15th
Amendment. Well, that compromise that protected slavery was all about keeping the Union together by keeping the South, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, over time it's evolved, and
right,
I would caution everybody at home that I really don't get my history and book learning from Michelle Bachmann, and I suggest that none of you do either.
No, we get it from a scholar at Yale Law School named Akhil Amar, who's written probably the best book about the Constitution called America's Constitution. Everyone should read it.
You can get that at Amazon.com, I'm sure.
That's right.
Doug, so obviously this thing evolves. You have this pledge up at constitutionalprogressives.org asking people to sign on and become a constitutional progressive that stands up for the whole Constitution, not just the parts that they find politically convenient. I've signed up there. How's that going?
It's going great. We have more than 32,000 people who signed the whole Constitution pledge. Again, it's constitutionalprogressives.org. We hope everyone who thinks that the Constitution is at bottom a fundamentally progressive document will go on the website and sign up and become part of the Constitutional Progressives community. It was launched with a partnership between Constitutional Accountability Center, my organization, People for the American Way, and Center for American Progress. And so it's really an effort to form a coordinated pushback to the Tea Party and their constitutional vision, and we need everyone's help.
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening at home and you are sick and tired of hearing conservatives talk about the Constitution, quoting from the Constitution when they're actually quoting from the Declaration of Independence, or claiming that Texas has a right to secede from the Union, or claiming that they are the true defenders of the Constitution. If you're tired of all that baloney, I encourage you all to go and visit constitutionalprogressives.org and sign up to be a constitutional progressive. You know, one of the things that occurs to me is, particularly this time, right now, with the super committee and deliberations, we're expecting some kind of an announcement soon, that we don't have honest brokers in this debate over the deficit, over our budget right now. We've got one side that is willing to come to the table and put everything on the table for negotiation, and you've got one side that claims to be doing that, but at the same time, almost all of their members have signed a blood pact with Grover Norquist that they will never raise taxes ever, ever, under any circumstances, even during times of war or during times of economic hardship. So basically, they're taking his pledge over the oath they have to the Constitution. Isn't that right?
And that's exactly right, Carl. There's 271 members of Congress, a few Democrats, but the vast majority are conservative Republicans who've said basically that I will never raise taxes unless Grover Norquist allows me to, and that is never. And so,
when in fact the Constitution gives them the right to raise taxes.
Well, the Constitution was in a large part about the ability of the federal government to raise taxes. I mean, this was passed. The founders were the soldiers in the Revolutionary War, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, who suffered at Valley Forge because the states didn't give them enough resources. And so they came to Philadelphia in large part to make sure we had a federal government that was capable of solving national problems. And the idea that the founders would support this attack on taxes, to support the balanced budget amendment, which basically requires, more than a majority of the members of Congress to support any tax increase or support
it's
any
ridiculous.
Change in fiscal policy is totally anathema.
Well, and Doug, I want to talk more about this so-called balanced budget amendment when we come back. If you can stick around for another segment, that'd be great. We're taking your calls. What do you think of gridlock Grover Norquist and his stranglehold on our ability to reach a deal in Washington? Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We'll take your calls after this break. We're talking to Doug Kendall, the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center, about their effort called gridlockgrover.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Gridlock Grover and what it means for you and your family. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, more on Gridlock Grover with Doug Kendall from the Constitutional Accountability Center. You know, this makes me want to rap, actually. I grew up not far from where that song talks about. So this is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me, follow me on Twitter and Facebook and everything else at carlfrisch.com. That's carlfrisch.com. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Gridlock Grover with Doug Kendall, the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center. You can find their campaign on Gridlock Grover at gridlockgrover.com. Doug, thanks for sticking around.
Sure, thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. We've got a call. David, who's watching on Free Speech TV in Pacific, Washington. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Carl. It's great to speak to you. I was just wondering, would it be true that Congress, most of the congressional members are tax lawyers, and that we also pay their wages by the millionaires and billionaires writing them off for working for them.
Doug, I don't know if they're all tax lawyers,
sure,
but a lot of them happen to be attorneys.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of attorneys in Congress. I don't know how many of them are actual tax lawyers.
I can think of one.
Right. Michelle Bachman, I think, is the only one that comes to mind.
She didn't want to do it, though. God
right.
made her.
No, she definitely didn't enjoy
through her husband
at the IRS. Right.
Yes. Well, explain to me the rationale behind this effort to take on Grover and what you guys ended up doing.
Sure, Carl. So, the effort is just stemmed around the fact that the Constitution requires every member of Congress to, and every public official in the state and federal level to take an oath to support the Constitution. And it's the simplest thing in the world to say that if you have you can't take two oaths. You can't pledge to support the Constitution and support Grover. And so he's trying to make lawmakers put his pledge and his views and his special interest ideology over their oath to the Constitution. And public officials can't do that. And that's what we're saying, and that's the message that actually is really kind of taken on. This is something that Barack Obama has said now in his Rose Garden speech. It's something that members of Congress of both parties, including a few people who had previously signed the pledge, have now backed away and said, you know what? The only oath I can take is to the Constitution, and that's what we're asking everyone to say.
And you're seeing cracks in that foundation. There was a Washington Post story that had a bunch of Republican congressmen who have signed this pledge saying, oh, I didn't know it meant forever.
Right. Yeah, no, there's we have a list of dozens of people who have signed the pledge are kind of backing off over the last couple months. And just this morning, I yesterday sent a personal letter to the chief of staff of every person listed by Grover Norquist as a signer of his pledge, and I asked every one of them to, you know, say first whether they still want to be listed as a pledge signer, because a lot have said, you know, I signed that 20 years ago. I'm not married to Grover Norquist. I'm married to my wife, and that's what they should say. And then others are saying, you know what, I signed the pledge, but I think my oath trumps that. And just this morning, you know, one of the people that we wrote to, a congressman from South Carolina, Trey Gowdy, came out and said, you know what, yeah, I may have signed that in a campaign, but I'm not going to follow that. What I'm going to follow is the Constitution. That's what we're asking people to do. It's what more and more people are doing, but it's what every member, it should be the simplest thing. It's
sure.
A total no-brainer. I sign an oath to the Constitution. That's what I have to follow, not some special interest pledge. And so it's taking on, but there's ton of work left to do.
And you had 13,000 some odd number of people.
That's right.
That sent messages to Grover. And have those been delivered yet?
Right. So yesterday we also, at gridlockgrover.com, we've been collecting letters to Grover Norquist telling him to affirm that the Oath of Office, the Constitution comes first, and it trumps their, you know, that the Constitution trumps his pledge and every other special interest pledge. He won't say it. He hasn't said it, but we're asking him to say it. And more than 13,000 Americans from around the country have signed that letter. Yesterday, we printed all those out. We put them in mail bags, mailed to Gridlock Grover. We walked them over to Americans for Tax Reform. We delivered them, put them in front of their sign in front of their building, and delivered them. And hopefully he'll get the message. We know that public officials are getting that message, and they're feeling the heat about this.
Well, I certainly hope so. I want to take another call before we have to say goodbye. We've got Corky from Rochester, New York, who's watching on Free Speech TV. Corky?
I think to take two pledges is treasonous and should be prosecuted as such. You can't pledge allegiance to two gods.
Right.
And you can't pledge allegiance to the flag and the people and then turn around and pledge allegiance to Grover Norquist and his doctor.
I mean, isn't that the crux of this, is that it's difficult for members to claim that they've, you know, pledged their oath to the Constitution and serve their master, Grover Norquist, at the same time, Doug?
There are just times when, even if you have a very strong anti-tax ideology, you have to recognize that the Republic needs more money, or just you have the freedom to vote the way you think your people need you to vote. And that's, you know, the oath is to serve we the people, not we the special interests. And that's what, when you sign up to Grover's pledge, that's what you're doing. You're serving, you know, Grover Norquist, not we the people.
And when you sign the letters at gridlockgrover.com, the American people are telling Grover to knock it off. Doug, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. That was Doug Kendall. He is the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center. You can sign their pledge at constitutionalprogressives.org. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking to patriotic millionaires. You won't want to miss it. Come back. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I am still Carl Frisch. I'll be here with you for the rest of the afternoon. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-THOM. That's 866-987-8466. I have breaking news right now that I want to cut to live. We have a wiretap, I understand, in an editorial board meeting with Herman Cain. Can we hear that audio?
I've narrowed your choices down to five unthinkable options. Each will cause untold misery.
I pick number three.
You don't even want to read them first?
I was elected to lead, not to read.
if you're just catching up with the pop culture reference, that's the Simpsons movie with a fictitious president, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the former governor of California, where I'm from. And Herman Cain has taken that as his new, you know, standard boilerplate answer whenever he doesn't have an answer to a question. So, for instance, if he was in that editorial board meeting with the Wisconsin the Milwaukee Sentinel, and they asked him about Libya, he would say, "I was elected to lead, not to read." If you ask him about his own 999 plan and how that's going to affect working families who can't afford food under it, he's going to say, "We need a leader who can lead, not one who can read." It just shows and underscores how much of a joke this guy is as a presidential candidate. But there are serious times out here, and we don't need jokes, that's for sure. One of the favorite stories I saw this week was the patriotic millionaires storming Capitol Hill. These were people who have made, you know, who are worth more than $1 million. A lot of them are, you know, former technology leaders, attorneys, respected people in their fields. And they descended on Washington, almost 24 of them, to carry a very simple message that was, tax me more. And they visited not just with Democrats and progressives, but they met with Tea Party members and super committee members and leaders from the House and Senate in both parties. And joining me now to talk about them, these patriotic millionaires, which you can find out more at patrioticmillionaires.org, is Erica Payne. She runs the Agenda Project up in New York City and deeply involved in the patriotic millionaires. Erica, thanks for joining me.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Carl.
So tell me about this trip. I mean, it sounds fascinating. There were like 21 millionaires descended on Washington to have these frank conversations with our leaders.
Yeah, it was really great. This group was formed a year ago during the lame duck session last year when people were thinking about whether or not to extend the Bush tax cuts, which they ultimately did. And these folks found that really frustrating. These are people who have annual incomes of more than $1 million a year, and that's an important distinction. So it's not their net worth. It's, you know, you know, some families will own a home, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people who bring in on an annual basis more than $1 million a year. And we now have had about 200 of them, including the founder of Ben & Jerry's, the actress Edie Falco from Nurse Jackie, and several other people sign a letter that says they want to pay more taxes. And so we've been working with them over the course of the last year to really try to push this message forward. And now as we go into these final debt deliberations of the super committee, they have a choice to make in front of them. So a bunch of the patriotic millionaires decided to head to Washington and take their case directly to a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans, as well as some Democrats. So it was
What was that like? I mean, you were all here. You arrived in Washington. What were you expecting?
Well, you know, you never know what to expect in Washington, except that you're probably going to see a lot of people talking out of both sides of their mouths. But we actually had a really successful trip. I think we sat down and talked to people with a wide range of views, including many who just don't think that there should be, almost seem to not think that there should be taxes at all, and had an opportunity to share with them the perspective of 200 people representing a group who, and I think this is important to know, there are only about, sort of depending on how you count it, about 300,000 or 400,000 people in the United States who make more than $1 million a year, and that's out of a population of 308 million. So it's really 0.1%. And so this is a pretty big chunk of them going down to Washington and saying, listen, we've got a problem. You know, we want to do our part to fix it.
Well, why don't they just donate the money to the Treasury if they want to pay more in taxes?
Yeah, this is the this is the conservatives' great sort of attempt at a gotcha.
It's their grown up, I know you are, but what am I kind of thing.
Well, I mean, it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad to have that be the response from people who are responsible for running our government, because, you know, these folks believe really strongly that our government isn't a charity. You know, this is the price you pay for citizenship, and if you don't want to pay the price for citizenship, then move to another country where your tax rate is lower. You know, these folks have benefited a lot from roads and bridges and universities and, you know, a lot of other things that taxpayer dollars fund, and they feel like they should pay more to reinvest in the next generation of innovation, which helps them be successful.
Right. Well, and along those lines, I mean, we have a call I want to take. We've got Ben who's listening on KTNS in Santa Barbara. Ben, you wanted to know why millionaires just don't pay more, right?
Yeah, I mean, why do we have to go and enact another law for people to pay more taxes? Why don't they just pull out their checkbooks and write a check, what they think is the right amount to give to the government?
Well, again, and I'm so glad that you brought this up, Ben. It's really a matter of, we all live in this country. How are we going to all do our part? And, you know, I think everybody knows that whether it's a team sport where some people don't pull their weight, or a company, a private company, there are some workers that pull their weight and some workers who don't. And so when you're talking about a whole country failing because some people aren't choosing to pull their weight, unfortunately, we do need to make it a mandatory thing. And so these patriotic millionaires want to make sure that they not only pay their fair share, but that also the other 300,000 people who make more than $1 million are also required to pay their fair share, because we don't want a lot of freeloaders in the country. We've got a problem in front of us, and we need to solve it. And,
well, and it's
not something that's going to be solved with private contributions.
And it's not another law, right? I mean, it's just raising the upper, you know, bracket in the tax code to what it was in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it's basically saying, do you think that we should have people who make more than $1 million a year start paying the same amount that they were paying 10 years ago before we even had a crisis? And so that seems to be the very minimum that we could ask people to do. And a lot of these patriotic millionaires think that there should be more requirement of those fortunate Americans than this, but that certainly, you know, this is the very least that we should be requiring of people at this moment where we have a problem.
But, you know, they say, Erica, if you tax these so-called job creators, they won't create jobs.
Right. This is one of the big myths, and this is one of the points that the millionaires spend a lot of time on in their meetings with the conservatives on the Hill. If you look at the group of people who are on the list, which you can see at patrioticmillionaires.org, those are some folks who, you know, have been involved in companies who have created a lot of jobs, and they all made the case that they personally are not job creators. I mean, and the businesses that they work for are job creators, but handing them more money back into their pockets is actually not at all stimulative for the economy, and it doesn't help create more jobs. So,
right. I mean, the only thing that creates, you know, the need for jobs is the demand for the products and services that these people are making.
Right.
And the only way you do that is by creating jobs and creating more income.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, it may be that, you know, one of the people who was with us was the 13th employee at Google. We also had the 59th employee at Google, and I think the 213th employee at Google. And Google certainly has, I think they have 30,000 employees now. So those guys were involved in creating a company that employed 30,000 people. But handing David Desjardins or Frank Jernigan or Doug Edwards, three of the people who were with us, another X thousand dollars a year, you know, maybe they will, you know, go buy something new with it or hire a gardener or whatever, but they're not in the business of creating jobs in the way that we should really think about creating jobs.
Right. You know, Tom Hartman talks about, you know, in the 70s when he had a small business, he was taking a lot of money out of the business and making a lot of money, but not investing a lot of the money back into the business. And his attorney came to his tax accountant, came to him and said, look, you need to stop taking money out of your business. You need to invest it in your company and grow your business, or else you're going to be taxed at a huge tax rate. That's how jobs are created in this country, is by people reinvesting in their businesses. And as it stands right now, the only thing I can figure out that they've bought with these huge windfalls they've been making over the last decade are a bunch of golden parachutes. Erica, will you stick around for another segment?
Yeah, I would be happy to.
All right, we're taking your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Filling in for Tom Hartman, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. And we're talking about the patriotic millionaires. We want to know your thoughts. Should the wealthy pay more? Should they pay their fair share? Let us know. Give us a call, and we'll chat with you. We're talking to Erica Payne from the Agenda Project, and we'll be back with her after the break, and I'll be back with you as well. So we're going to take this break, and we'll be right back. And apparently I was a little quick on the draw there, which happens in radio. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with the Patriotic Millionaires and their meeting with Grover Norquist. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Erica Payne about the Patriotic Millionaires that were on Capitol Hill for much of the day yesterday, or on Wednesday, rather, and what they were up to. They met with members of the Super Committee. They met with Republicans in Congress, Democrats in Congress, and Grover Norquist, who we spent some time talking about with Doug Kendall. Erica, what was the meeting with Grover Norquist like?
You know, it was pretty intense. For anybody who doesn't know who Grover Norquist is, he's one of the leading conservatives in the country and is also probably one of the most powerful people in the country that most Americans have probably never heard of. He runs an organization called Americans for Tax Reform, which advocates basically absolutely no taxes as far as the eye can see, and he's gotten a lot of members of Congress to sign pledges through the years that they would vote for no new taxes whatsoever, and those pledges have really snarled up our legislative system. And so what we're finding now is that Grover kind of has a chokehold on a lot of conservative congresspeople and senators, and as a result, any sort of compromise that might be a reasonable compromise that's achieved through the super committee is really problematic and far from being done because of him. And so we took, I think, six of the Patriotic Millionaires, an executive from AOL, a couple of the Google guys and some other folks, and went and sat down with him and had about a 45-minute long conversation about taxes, and it spiraled into a lot of other issues, and there were some
Somalia, I understand, was discussed.
Well, I think one of the Patriotic Millionaires challenged him that if he didn't want to pay any taxes and wanted less government, he could go to Somalia and see how that worked out for him.
It's libertarian paradise there. I mean, it's been sprinkled with libertarian magic dust.
Well, I mean, this is one of the cases that the millionaires wanted to make, want to really make to the country, because this is a time when the public has to weigh in on this issue, because this decision, the deadline for the decision is Wednesday, but the real deadline is probably tomorrow or Sunday, and maybe at the latest Monday, because once they've come to a compromise, if they do that, the compromise then has to go to the Congressional Budget Office to score it, so the Congressional
Right.
Budget Office can say how much they actually saved before they're allowed to put it out on Wednesday.
Exactly. And I want to take a call from Kevin in Portland, Oregon about taxes. Kevin.
Hi. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing
hey,
well.
Hey, Kevin.
Good. Hello. I'm going to say, I just wanted to say that, I mean, this line that the job creators will not create jobs if you raise taxes on them is baloney.
Yeah.
Because these people hate paying taxes so much that if you do raise the tax on them, they will create jobs or look for other investments to lower their income so they don't have to pay the taxes to the government.
Right.
So how do you guys feel about that?
I mean, there have been studies done about what happens when you give what group of people tax cuts. So there's empirical data that you can focus on to make the decision about this. And basically, if you give tax cuts to people in the lower income scales, that puts money directly into their pocket. And what they tend to do is to go out and spend it on the necessities of life,
right.
Food, energy, et cetera. If you give it to people in this case, the Patriotic Millionaires are in the top 0.1%, as I said earlier. If you give people in that wealth level their taxes back, they don't tend to spend it. And so
right.
As a result, it doesn't increase demand. It's, I think it's the 11th most stimulative thing you can do for the economy. So there are lots of things that would go ahead of that. And what they tend to do is invest it in bonds and in financial instruments.
Things that don't directly feed back into the economy.
That don't make jobs.
Well, Erica, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about the Patriotic Millionaires. People can find out more at patrioticmillionaires.org. They can find out more about what you do at theagendaproject.org as well. Erica, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much, Carl.
Absolutely. Joining me now to talk about what's happening out there in the world with the Super Committee, I am talking to Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
So what's happening?
Not much. the six most moderate among them, three Republicans, three Democrats, met last night, had absolutely no breakthrough. At the moment, everybody's getting ready for a fail.
No, really?
Yes, they're getting ready for a fail. And the best-case scenario is that each side presents their figures, gets the CBO to score them, and then blames the other side. That's what looks actually like is going to happen. And then each side next year will run on that.
Well, you know,
politically.
I'm not entirely surprised. I mean, when you've got one party that has basically signed a blood oath saying that they will not raise taxes under any circumstances ever, and you've got the other party willing to put Medicaid and Social Security on the chopping block, I mean, somebody's not coming to the table as an honest broker.
Well, I think that is the argument the Democrats are going to be making, and that is the gamble that they're going to take with the American public. That is what they're going to try and do. Meanwhile, over in the Senate, they're debating the defense authorization bill, which the White House threatened to veto yesterday over language on detainee policy that has actually riven Democrats and is really quite exciting because you've got Carl Levin versus Pat Leahy and Dianne Feinstein.
That's fascinating. It's not often that you see the Senate Democrats taking on the president.
No, you don't. And you've got Carl Levin and John McCain together. It's a question really over what do you do with detainees and how do you hold them? And there is a big dispute over presidential power. The bill has been redrafted once and it's still not to the White House's satisfaction. And it's not clear at this point what is going to happen with it.
Well, I guess we'll just have to watch and wait and see. Victoria, I want to thank you for coming on and letting us know what's happening out there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. It is 1:56, bottom of the hour. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com, and obviously you can find out more about Tom's show at tomhartman.com. Sign up for the podcast, watch the programs, etc. We'll be back in just a bit.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. That's at Carl Frisch, K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. I want to get a few of your calls in before we go to our next guest. Let's talk to Cheyenne, who's listening in Los Angeles on KTLK. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the pledge with Grover Norquist. I have a Constitution and a Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
I read it every day, and it says absolutely nothing. It says Congress to have the power to levy taxes. Doesn't say Grover Norquist. So if they taking an oath to Grover Norquist, they're in violation of their oath to the Constitution and the people of the United States. They either should be sued or brought up on charges. Because that sounds to me, if you violate your oath to the Constitution,
well, they certainly,
it sounds to me like you possibly committing treason.
Well, they certainly should make a decision. They should certainly decide whether or not they are going to stand up for their oath, which they make whenever they're sworn in to Congress, or this pledge that some of them signed maybe 20 years ago. It's quite ridiculous, if you ask me. Let's get in. I have a special guest on the phone. Kenny Pick is with us. Kenny, sorry for making you wait on hold for so long.
Hey, no worries, Carl. Long time no speak. Yeah,
yes.
I just finished my lunch. Nice plate of vegetables and some water I did not get. I just wanted to call and say thank you for feeding my Herman Cain derangement syndrome. And I think it's funny. Way back in June, John Stewart made the observation that Herman Cain did not like to read. And do you remember that?
I do.
Got in
I do.
A little bit of criticism for that. And now we have Herman Cain openly admitting that he does not like to read.
No, he's running to lead, not to read.
Yeah,
I was elected to read, not to read.
Which, you know, if you take the Bush administration, you know, they didn't read those intelligence reports. So, you know, he comes in a long line of non-reading Republican politicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, great show today, Carl. I don't want to keep you, but
thanks, Kenny.
Have a great one.
Have a good one. All right, joining me now to talk about 2012 and the stuff going on in Penn State is a good friend of mine, Cliff Schechter. You can find more about him at LibertasLLC.com. Cliff, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, buddy. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Always good to be here with you.
So let's talk about 2012 before we get into more serious stuff. One would not assume that the presidential race would not be serious. But with this cast of characters, SNL scripts are writing themselves.
Yeah, well, you know, with the current Star Wars bar lineup and the kind of revolving leadership, a revolving position at the head of the pack, you know, because I guess the Groper is gone now. The Doper is gone, the Groper is gone, so I guess we have to go on to
the Flanderer.
Gingrich and his harem.
Well, yeah, the Flanderer or the... Well, I've been contending for a while that the only reason he's still in this race is because... he's trying to pay off that debt to Tiffany's.
You got to pay off the debt to Tiffany's, and let's face it, when you join the race and you go on that nice long 2-week cruise to Greece, something's got to pay for that, right?
Well, yeah, I had no idea that breakfast at Tiffany's was a buffet.
Well, when Newt Gingrich is there, I think it goes well into dinner. But
that's right.
Story.
So, why do you think it is that, you know, Mitt Romney is sticking there at 25%? He's not been able to break that ceiling, and meanwhile, virtually every other candidate in the race has had their turn as the front runner in this race.
Well, it's amazing. I can only, you know, surmise looking at it. I definitely can't exactly put myself in the mind of a base GOP voter, which is, kind of makes me happy tonight.
Oh, it's easy. Here's what you need to not pay attention to. Science.
I need that to be the
science.
Sorry, Carl.
The media.
Right.
Math, letters, right. Numbers, and shapes. Those all have liberal bias.
That's a very
now you're a Republican base voter.
I think
right.
Immediately is suspect. Yeah, you know it's that you know the party in general is crazy, but you'd have to think they come up with somebody better than this group of guys. And I mean, in a year when you would have expected that Barack Obama would be vulnerable, and he still could be, which is a scary thought, just because obviously with the economy where it is,
which is exactly where they want it to be. By the way, I mean it's not surprising. Given that when the Republicans took over, I think it was Mitch McConnell who openly said, look, our number one goal in the Senate is to defeat Barack Obama.
Right, and Jim DeMint said they wanted the health care bill to be his Waterloo. I'm surprised he knew what that meant. He probably thought that was a water slide. Somewhere.
Well, and Michelle Bachmann said, I know about Waterloo.
That's right. That's where
I'm from
where
there.
John Wayne or John Wayne Gacy. Or
right, one of the John Waynes.
People are active in movies.
But she's never made a gaffe, by the way. She said that I have never made a gaffe, which I guess is like the meta gaffe.
See, that's what's amazing here is you and I can literally just keep making these jokes the entire day. I mean, this group of people, and you know, I think that's the answer. You know, I mean, I may not be, for example, a Buddy Romer fan, but why is he not up on that stage? He's talking about limiting campaign contributions to $100. You know, could you tell me that a guy that was governor and was a congressman and the rest is not as qualified as Herman Cain?
Well, and he's a former Democrat, just like Rick Perry.
That's a good point, too. Rick Perry was a big Al Gore fan way back in the day. You know, so I mean, I think it seems to me they're obviously doing a job of controlling who can get up there. And they're only allowing mostly these clowns. I think the establishment wants Mitt Romney, and quite frankly, how do you ensure that Mitt Romney gets in there? Besides, if you put these guys next to Mitt Romney, he looks like a paragon of virtue, you know?
Yeah, he looks like the owner of the used car dealership.
That's exactly right.
You know, he'll cut anybody's prices. just like he'd cut anybody's job. So is it possible? I mean, basically what we're up against is a clock. Mitt Romney is trying to be the nominee, and the way he's trying to do it is the way that most Republican nominees are chosen, frankly, is running up the clock and being inevitable. You know, every Republican nominee going back 30 years has run for president at one point or another and lost before becoming the nominee, with the exception of one candidate, George W. Bush. Is that a risky strategy given how low he is in the polls?
I don't know. I mean, it is, but I think it may be his only strategy. You're never going to convince anybody to fall in love with Mitt Romney. I mean, let's be honest here. First of all, nobody knows on any given day where he's standing on any single issue. But in addition to that, he's not a very likable character. You know,
no.
I mean, he'd be the villain in virtually any movie you put together, and for obvious reasons. I mean, as you're alluding to, cutting people's jobs. I mean, the guy made money. He kind of almost invented the private equity industry. He certainly was a pioneer in sending jobs to China. He was out there, you know, we got to give him credit. He saw the trend. He started getting jobs over to China at least 10 years before most other people did. So.
Well, I was on a radio show the other day, and somebody said, well, look, when he was at Bain Capital, he was making these struggling companies profitable, and sometimes you have to let some of the fat go. And I said, you know what, that's probably the case in some of those cases, that some of those businesses needed to cut some employees to remain profitable. But by and large, the companies that he fired people from were perfectly profitable to begin with.
Right.
These are companies that are making, you know, the problem that we live in today is that because of the way Wall Street is structured now, a company cannot make $1 billion in profit every year and still be successful in the eyes of Wall Street. They need to go from $1 billion one year to $1.5 billion to $2 billion to $3 billion to $4 billion. And what does that do? And that's all profit. It creates
right.
a need to cut employees.
Well, yeah, you know what? If he wanted to cut the fat, he would have cut himself out and the other guys.
Right.
Because they're the ones who were, to go with continue with that metaphor, they're the ones that were gorging themselves or pigging out, quite frankly. They take over companies. There was a great story the other day about one of these companies, and a healthcare company, I can't think of the name, where they installed themselves as a majority of the board, and they basically just plundered the whole thing and set themselves up with huge bonuses and the rest while they were firing people. So really, if you wanted to cut the fat out to make sure that this company was actually was doing a great job working and giving shareholders value and, I don't know, employing people, which is a nice thing to do if you're a company, then they would have gotten rid of themselves because they were the ones who frankly, were the biggest drag on this company.
But that's what it's all about here. It's about the corporate's, it's about the corporate leaders' profits and their money that they get to take home. And it's not about the workers who make that money for them. Cliff, can you stick around for another segment?
Oh, I'd love to.
All right, I want to talk a little bit more about 2012. In particular, Sarah Palin finally came back into our lives, which was something I've missed for quite a while.
Oh, God, we
This is the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to Cliff Schechter. We want to hear from you. What do you think about 2012? Give us a call, 866-987-8466, toll-free. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up, we'll have Word Salad with Sarah Palin. Oh, how I've missed her. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. Find me at carlfrisch.com or on Twitter at Carl Frisch. You can also find me on Facebook at Carl V. Frisch. Believe it or not, there was another Carl Frisch that had already taken the other. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Cliff Schechter. You can find more about him at libertasllc.com. Cliff, thanks for sticking around.
Thanks, Carl. Don't let that other Carl steal your thunder on Facebook.
I hate to break it to him, but the other Carl is actually me. It just happens to be my personal account.
Oh,
so
okay.
we do have a call. I mean, there's been some news this afternoon that the balanced budget amendment has failed in the House of Representatives, which I give a uproarious round of applause to that news.
I'm actually impressed with that.
Right. Don, listening on KPOJ in Albany, Oregon.
Hey, good morning, Carl.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
I should say. Yeah, that's what I was going to tell you. Balanced budget amendment failed in the U.S. House.
That's
I
excellent.
I saw that on C-SPAN a little bit ago.
That's excellent news. For those that
don't know,
the balanced budget amendment was not simply telling us that the budget had to be balanced every year.
Mm-hmm.
It was saying that the budget had to be balanced and that only a two-thirds vote could raise taxes.
Uh-huh. And they're also voting on whether or not to hash out that unionizing workplaces deal after the, you know, after the Thanksgiving break.
Well, you know,
like that was passing.
These Republicans, they keep on voting on stuff that isn't going to create a single job, and
I know,
I think it's going to come back to haunt them. Don,
know,
thanks
like
for
you know, like that Grover Norquist pledge will eventually blow up in his face big time. Mark my words.
I consider them marked. Thanks, Don. Cliff, what do you make of that?
That it failed. I mean, obviously, that's a great thing. I mean, in and of themselves, if Bill Clinton balanced the budget, it's not a bad thing. But as we know, as we've seen from every committee, every super committee, every little gang, you know, when they play out Gangs of New York, you know, and they're little tough guys and they're meeting, all these things end up coming to the same conclusion because they're all stocked with rich people, which you pointed out earlier when you're talking about the insider trading and the rest.
Right.
You know, if budgets could be balanced by, let's say, I don't know, taking out 30, 40, 50% of what we wastefully spend on defense. Sure. That sounds like, I mean, maybe not right now, don't get me wrong, because we're in economic times where I think we need to continue spending money. But, you know, if you were to bring the economy back, yeah, that's one way. The other way is not to give subsidies to big oil and give subsidies to big agri and the rest. I mean, there's a lot of ways to balance the budget. The problem is, as you point out, when they have these balanced budget amendments, they always end up having just being about not raising taxes on wealthy people and about keeping defense spending through the roof so they can keep providing contractors with government money nonstop and in our
right.
crony capitalism atmosphere. And of course, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and programs that actually help people get cut. So,
well, you know, it's tough out there. I mean, it's hard out there for a GOP pimp these days.
it really is.
I mean, if you look at Newt Gingrich today, or the other day rather, was talking about his income having fallen since he announced that he was running for president. You know, back when he was a historical advisor, I guess is what he's saying he was. He wasn't a lobbyist. He was not a lobbyist for Freddie and Fannie. He simply advised them on the history of housing.
And you know, Carl, what upsets me is I was at American University for a bit, getting my PhD, and I ended up leaving to do some of the political work I do. And now I know if I just finished that dissertation, $1.6 million was waiting for me. It's
right, $1.6 million, he was paid, according to him, to be a housing historian who told them not to give money to people who can't afford it. He was paid $1.6 million.
If only I knew the history work out there was that good, I wouldn't have made it.
Let me read you a quote from him. This is from, I'm not sure, I'm reading it off of Daily Coast right now. Free plug for Marcos. During a recent interview in South Carolina, Gingrich said that ending his involvement in the healthcare think tank and other businesses was difficult. He also said that if he fails to win the Republican nomination, he doesn't know whether he will do anything as big as the center again. Quote, you know, I've made a good deal of income off the speeches and off of being a commentator, Gingrich said. All of that went away, so it just got to be much more challenging.
It's tough when you can't, you know, these guys who believe in the sweat of your brow and working hard and no welfare, but it's tough when you can't just give a speech for $50,000 or like the Center for Health Transformation to be specific, for quote, direct new interaction, which, by the way, you could only get if you were one of the people with him.
Well, you know,
while he was serving his wife with papers.
He's making it sound like he can't afford that $500,000 bill he's got at Tiffany's, and maybe he's going to have to start buying, you know, the open heart collection at Kay's Jewelers for Mrs. Gingrich.
I don't know. What did he do? Because these guys, this Center for Health Transformation collected $37 million in 6 years, according to the Washington Post, from different healthcare companies and trade groups. What did he do with all? I mean, okay, $500,000 to Tiffany's, lots of nice Greek cruises. I guess when you've got like 14 wives, alimony becomes an issue.
Well, let's be honest. He's had three previous wives, one of which he served divorce papers on when she was suffering from cancer in the hospital. I just want to make it clear what we're talking about here.
Well, I was trying to make that point, that's what I consider to be, I'm even grossed out saying this, direct new interaction. But apparently,
well, to make it even more clear, the second wife was cheated on with the third wife, who happened to be a member of the congressional staff when Newt was impeaching Bill Clinton.
Right, for lying about sex, quote unquote.
Right.
You know, he was lying about sex. Yeah, I know. Newt is he's fantastic, and I think he takes all the worst traits of Mitt Romney and perhaps makes them all worse. He's less likable. Who thought that was possible? He is more consistent on what he stands for one day and the next. Just came out, of course, that he was very much on the record in favor of healthcare mandates in 2007.
Oh, yeah, everybody was. I mean, he was in favor of them in the 90s with Bob Dole.
Yeah, I just wrote my column this week on how, you know, this past week on how dysfunctional the the Senate is, and I chose to look at one Chuck Grassley, who was busy mocking victims or survivors of the Tucson massacre the other day. And also, of course, Grassley was another one who co-sponsored that healthcare mandate before the death panels came up. You know, he started talking up death panels and unconstitutional healthcare mandates and all the other stuff he freaked out about while we were trying to pass the healthcare bill. And he was, of course, on the Gang of Six that was supposed to be responsibly negotiating that.
So, yeah, you know what? Spell check was invented for the BlackBerry because of Chuck Grassley's tweeting. Cliff, can you stick around a little bit longer?
As long as you'll have me, buddy.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Cliff Schechter. Give us a call, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're going to talk about the Penn State sex abuse crisis, how it's all about the money.
Thank God it's
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I am Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com, on Twitter, on Facebook, everything. Carl Frisch, K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. If you're just joining us, we're taking your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. We're talking to Cliff Schechter. Cliff is a Democratic strategist. He writes a column that you can find online at Al Jazeera English. Cliff, let's talk a little bit about what's happening at Penn State. You've got a great piece up at Al Jazeera English, how to create a culture of rape. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, you know, when I write these pieces, I sadly, and that's kind of the conversation we're having here right now, I try to look at kind of the broader cultural trends and what ends up, you know, leading to like what happened at Penn State. And obviously, what I talk about is it's not, you know, the Jerry Sanduskys, sadly, have always existed and will. I mean, is there a way we could discover them sooner by putting, you know, if we had more money into certain social programs and if we had more money into criminal prevention and then the rest? Oh, yeah, maybe, but there's always going to be these guys, there's these types of guys that prey on kids. It's a sickness and it's terrible and we need to stop them. And yet, but it clashing against the culture right now that we have of money buying everything. And we've already discussed this a little bit because we talked about Mitt Romney,
right,
you know, pioneering sending jobs to China. It used to be there was a point in this country, you know, I know Tom, when he hosts the show, talks a lot about this, and I think a lot of us agree about this. This country went on a fundamentally different path after Reagan was elected.
Yes.
And the values that had really represented this country had really built itself on for 200 years, you know, were thrown aside to quick profits and, you know, the corporate rule, really, and in the end, the profits are what matter, and status based on income and everything. And the other thing, none of that existed before, but man, it became on steroids after that. And so this is part of that. College football has become big business. I mean, Penn State makes $50 million each home game. And, you know, Joe Paterno has become a saint there for you know, in essence, the kids love him, but he makes them a heck of a lot of money.
Right.
So in that kind of an atmosphere where money is what's important, and you really have a college football program that really is a corporation, this is what happens in corporations. You know, abuse is
protect stored. Profits at all costs.
That's exactly it. You know, when Herman, and I brought in the Herman Cain, because, you know, when the Herman Cain story, because, of course, when Herman Cain and the National Restaurant Association is, you know, I'm not equating them to the two necessarily, but they're both forms of sexual predatory behavior. And when he does what he does, you just quickly cover it up with a $35,000 settlement, and it's gone, because the important thing is protecting your brand, is protecting profit, is protecting.
Right.
And it's the same thing at Penn State, and that Joe Paterno could look the other way. As far as I'm concerned, look, I've got two young boys, and so, you know, there's a personal element for me, too. The sickening thought of all this stuff, of looking at this, knowing that at the very least, since 2002, they knew this was going on. This guy Sandusky was bringing kids still to practice games as late as 2007. So, I mean, for 5 years, at the very least, probably a lot more than that.
Meanwhile, by the way, the chancellor at Penn State lobbied the state government to exempt them from having to report this kind of stuff.
Of course, right? I mean, and remember, university presidents these days make seven-figure salaries, and a lot of that is because of the money that's brought in by some of these sports programs. And so they're all, you know, the head of athletics is making probably a bit, I'm sure, a six-figure salary. I'm sure it's the same thing. And it's not to begrudge them the salaries they're making. It's more of the fact that their prestige and their financial situation is based upon a lot based upon these programs. And so, you know, they don't want to rock the boat. And it's been corporatized like so much. Like you brought up, I think, education earlier. How education? We don't want to pay for the kids to go to school anymore. You know, what we want to pay for is for guys to profit off of education. You know,
well, and I mean, it's so clear.
Sectors of our economy.
It's so clear that this is all about money. I mean, look at college football just from a baseline. I mean, the reason that we have the bowl championship series is so that these teams don't actually have to compete for the number one title. The schools think that they can make more money if they always go to a bowl game.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, in the long run, you'll have, you know, the contentiousness between schools of who's really number one when there's only one way to find out, just like in professional football. And that's why, you know, I support the work of groups like the Sports Fans Coalition at sportsfans.org, who are fighting to reform the BCS system and bring us a championship game.
Carl, you mean you didn't support Ari Fleischer and his flacking for the BCS?
I'd be
shocked that he would have taken that on, considering he was in for fairness on so many other areas of life.
Yeah, right.
that's the thing. It all ties in. And I'm sorry, you know, for people looking, you know, I criticize Democrats when they're wrong. I criticize Blue Dogs all the time. But, you know, not shocking that Ari Fleischer would go to work for the BCS. Not shocking that Jerry Sandusky was a friend of Rick Santorum and a conservative Republican who was given the Angels in Adoption Award.
Well, and let's also remember, I mean, Joe Paterno's son ran for Congress as a right-wing Republican.
That is true, too, and Joe Paterno himself is a close friend of the Bushes. You know, I mean, these are all tied in. These guys are all part of a culture. It is part of a culture that talks, that respects money, profit, everything else. Those are the values that matter. Creativity doesn't matter. How we as a society function overall, the public good, doesn't matter. If any of that stuff did matter, you wouldn't hollow out factories in the Midwest and send jobs abroad. You wouldn't allow kids to be raped, you know, while you know this is going on to protect a football program. You wouldn't try to corporatize education and make profit over it instead of educating kids. And we could go on and on, obviously. I often, in some of the stuff I do, take on the NRA, which is, again, used to be an organization that taught people how to use firearms. Now it's simply controlled by arms dealers and gun manufacturers. And all it's about, you can die in a place like Tucson so they can make more money. Because if they institute background checks, then you might actually not allow a criminal to get a gun, and then they make less money.
Right.
Everything has become that way, you know, and that's the sign of a sick culture. You know, and taking this country, which I believe in and which I still think is a great country, and at least for 200 years, with many mistakes we made, and terrible mistakes before that, from slavery until not allowing women's rights to you know, persecution of the gay community and what we did to the Native American community. I don't apologize for any of that, but at least we were always moving in the right direction. And sadly, it feels like since the 1980s, we've been doing just the opposite.
Right. I want to take a call really quick while we have time. Sebastian, who's listening on KTLK in Los Angeles, your thoughts.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
You know, I agree with almost everything that was just said in terms of, you know, college football being a business and Penn State specifically being a brand. But I've really got to take exception with dragging Joe Paterno into this. I realize I'm in the minority of public opinion on this. But by all accounts, you know, he did not do anything to these boys. He did not personally witness or hear anything happening to these boys. He had hearsay allegations coming from, you know, one of his kind of underlings. And he reported that to his superiors, which was in compliance with the university policy.
Hang on a second. Let's look at how you phrased that. He had hearsay from one of his underlings.
Right.
Is that how you would describe the relationship between Paterno and his, I think it was the assistant coach, wasn't it?
McQuarrie, yeah.
McQuarrie was an assistant coach.
He was just an underling. They didn't have a relationship where you might be able to trust him.
You know, well, I hate to go into this, but if you don't mind my jumping in, Carl, but again, you know, look, Paterno shouldn't be more persecuted or gone after than anyone else because he's more famous. And that's not why I'm doing it, because it's the president of the university and all these other guys knew. But I'm sorry, what I can't listen to, I can listen, look, I respect we can debate this, but what I can't allow to go unchallenged is when you're sitting here and saying hearsay, his assistant coach witnessed a older,
assault.
Larger man anally raping a 10-year-old in a shower. He claims to it. You know, he now said in his testimony he heard a rhythmic slapping noise. I'm sorry to have to go into those details, but that is what was going on to a 10-year-old. Paterno was told about this the next day by the guy, and all he did was fulfill his legal obligation. He told the two guys above him, let it go, never followed up on that, never followed up on what happened to this kid. And in as late as 2007, at Joe Paterno's college practices, this very same man, Jerry Sandusky, was bringing an 11-year-old as part of this charity that he was working at to watch the games. Is there any way Paterno didn't know what was happening to that 11-year-old? Is there any way that in Paterno's mind, this second mile charity should have been allowed to continually have Jerry Sandusky at its helm and allow him in close contact with kids? This is also in light of a 1998 investigation, which Paterno also knew about, where a mother complained because her son came home sobbing because Jerry Sandusky was showering with him and, quote, his private parts were touching him and he was bear hugging him. So when you know,
well,
Paterno
and, you know,
knew about all of that.
Well, and then you take into consideration Paterno's actions or lack of actions. I mean, one thing he did do was transfer the ownership of his own home to his wife, which looks like he's trying to protect his property in case he gets sued.
I don't know. I try to be respectful of other people's opinions on this stuff, but again, you know, beyond how terrible I think this is, maybe for me, having a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old son, I just can't listen to someone saying, you know, it's defensible that somebody knew for at least 5 years, probably more like a decade, that this had happened and still was watching his former assistant coach bring young boys to practice, at least on one occasion, I'm guessing more, and knew that he was the helm of an organization that was using the reputation of Penn State and Joe Paterno to convince parents that it was a safe place for their kids and was raping them. I mean, I'm sorry, if he's not culpable morally, then I'm not sure what culpable morally is at that point.
Yeah, and it's sad when anybody tries to assuage the guilt of any of these people with explanations. I mean, we're going to get to the bottom of this one way or another, and it doesn't look like it's going to be pretty. Cliff, can you stick around a little longer?
As I said, man, until you kick me off,
all right,
I'm
here,
Carl.
We'll kick you off in the next segment. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with Cliff Schechter, and we'll talk a little bit more about Penn State. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, this final segment, I am Carl Frisch. Please go to my website, carlfrisch.com, and sign up for email updates so you can find out whenever I'm hosting for Tom or anybody else, and also get my column that I write every week over email. You can also follow me on Twitter, at Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Cliff Schechter. Cliff, we've got a couple calls I want to get to here.
Sure.
Randy, who's listening on KTLK in Long Beach, California.
Hi, guys. Hey, listen, you're definitely making an independent out of a hardcore long-term Democrat here today. I'm not buying this connection between what has happened at Penn State and Mitt Romney or Ronald Reagan when you can think of Michael Jackson and probably 100 others we could think of right now. I think we need to focus on what's important here.
Randy, I think you're missing the point, though. The connection is not about the rape of children. The connection is about why somebody would cover it up.
They
don't want to get their name attached to something like that.
This is about a culture since Reagan, and I would be the first to say.
Oh, give me a break since Reagan. We had Manson before Reagan.
Let me for a second, okay?
It's about these children in this case.
That this has a lot to do with a variety of people, including many Democrats. I could sit here and talk about, you know, the Evan Bayes of the world and Joe Lieberman's and others who've been a part of this, too. This is not about party. It's that Reagan fundamentally changed the direction of the country. And after that, both Democrats and Republicans, I think that certainly there are many good progressive Democrats that do not just respect the almighty dollar. But quite frankly, the entire Republican apparatus, the conservative culture-creating apparatus, and too many who sort of supported a neoliberal philosophy have headed towards, you know, money being everything. And if you don't see that in our culture, you don't see that in the cover-up at Penn State, I don't know what you're looking at.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and like I said, this is not about what happened there. This is about why they would cover something like that up. And it's why they would cover up any scandal, frankly.
That's exactly right. I mean, again, you know, if you've been alive long enough, and I'm not even getting into the fact that you know, saying that whether you and I are old men, Carl, because I was a pretty young guy during the Reagan years. But if you studied all history, if you look at things, if you look at what, you know, the top 1% took in about 9% of income in 1979, now they're up to about 26 or 27%. I mean, if you don't look at the fundamental changes, if you don't look at what happened after Glass-Steagall, you know, after we were allowed the merchant banks to again join with the big insurance guys,
right,
join with the big investment banks. And that was a mistake Bill Clinton made. I mean, I'll put blame where blame. I think Clinton was a great president all around, but you know what? He was too pro-corporate, and he allowed Phil Graham and others to convince him, you know, and some of his Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, that was the right thing to do. A terrible mistake. There just has been
absolutely
too much deference towards corporations. They are not people. They never were people.
No, and if they were people, you know what? I bet Mitt Romney would not allow one male corporation to marry another male corporation. We've got James who's watching on Free Speech TV in we just lost James. We've got Kathy in West Kingston, Rhode Island. Kathy, thanks for joining us. Oh, I don't think we've got Kathy now.
We're scaring people away.
I know. Look at you.
I think it is. You know, another important point is in Mississippi the other day, Carl.
Oh, we've got Kathy back, Cliff. Let's go to Kathy.
Yep.
Kathy, hello.
Yes. Am I on the air?
You are.
Okay. I don't want to defend McQuarrie, but I want to say that there was an experiment done called Milgram, where people were encouraged to give shocks to aid in learning, and even though they went over the threshold of what they were told safety was, because there was authority there, they were willing to do what they were told. And I think McQuarrie probably was just so intimidated by authority there, personally, that he couldn't stand up and do what was right. And I don't think that I think the institution should have behaved better.
I think everybody could have behaved better. Cliff, before we close out, the underlying thing here is about returning to responsibility, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I will say that what our caller just said, the Milgram experiments were hugely important in sort of teaching us about authoritarianism and how it thrives. And yes, people, when they're told to do something, sometimes will do things that are completely against their morality. But the key to not having that kind of a system, the key to not having a corporatist system, is people need to be personally accountable, as you just said, Carl. They need to stand up, even if it might cost them their job. I mean, I understand it's a tough economy. People worry about all sorts of things that we shouldn't have to worry about, frankly, if the social safety net was anything close to what it should be. But, you know, that doesn't mean you can't see a 10-year-old being raped. There are certain things you just can't do. You can't see a 10-year-old being raped and say, well, I need to just be quiet about it, so I'm going to go about my business. Just the way if you know government is torturing people, or if you know of other things going on, people being whisked away at night, you know, at some point you have to sit up there and say, what is my moral responsibility here to do something about it?
Right.
And McQuarrie, I understand what your caller said, but at the same time, there is a moral responsibility there that if he didn't think he should have followed up on it, and if Joe Paterno wasn't doing what needed to be done, if the president wasn't doing what needed to be done, then he should have gone. I don't care if it's the FBI, it's the outside police, it's whoever needs to be. You know, when it comes to a child rapist, you need to bang down every door and do everything in your power.
Right, and my understanding is that apparently he did go to the police at some point or another. But beside the point, we're talking about responsibility here, and there's plenty of responsibility to go around in this whole matter. Cliff, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And anybody who wants more information on Cliff Schechter can go to his website, Libertas LLC. It's been a great afternoon with all of you, Tom's audience. I want to thank Tom Hartman for letting me fill in for him today. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H.com. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I also want to thank Tom's team for making today a delight. And hopefully I'll be back with you again soon. Thanks for everything.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.